Astronomy 2 Special Relativity, Lecture 14.
Where we got to last time was almost the end of Chapter 8. I thought I might manage to get to the end of Chapter 8 in time, but there was still a little bit left over. But that's fine, because that gives us an opportunity to recap the flood of quite sophisticated, the sequence of quite sophisticated ideas that we covered last time. And one of the key things, indeed one of the key things of the whole of Chapter 8, is the sequence of restatements, of successively stronger restatements of the equivalence principle. Can you remember the first one? I was talking about uniform gravitational fields. The second version was talking about local free-falling, non-rotating laboratories, local inertial frames, and how they were the thing that we could understand, that we already in a sense understand from our pre-relativistic physics. That's basically Newton's laws. And they are the bridge to a different way of approaching the question of what gravity is, or what it means to be moving under gravity. They're how we go from the physics we understand to the physics we don't yet. And the third version of it was a more mathematical version of the equivalence principle, which said that if you were that in general, if you are in a local inertial frame, you're moving under the influence of gravity, or moving well away from all gravitating bodies, and physics works as Newton special relativity says it does, then there's nothing, a law that's expressed in geometrical form, things like momentum, energy momentum is conserved, let's stick with that, energy momentum is conserved, that's a physical law expressed in geometrical form, in the form of the energy momentum vector, that does not change its form when talking about a curved space-time. There's no extra complication that arises when you're falling through a curved space-time, of what would be very highly curved space-time. So the physics of that inertial frame are not any more complicated. And that's actually quite a big deal, because you could imagine that there would be extra physical features that would happen because you're in a curved the space-time you're in is locally curved, and they don't happen. I'm blethering on about it because it is quite important, but I appreciate it doesn't sound that big a deal right at this point. But a quick question. I don't think you've studied Maxwell. You've possibly heard of, but you haven't studied Maxwell's equations yet. You're possibly aware of what I'll tell you now. The Maxwell's equations are the way. I mentioned them in Chapter 2. Maxwell's equations are the way that electromagnetism, so light, radio, all these things, are described in a format which James Clerk Maxwell developed at the end of the 19th century. And we can write those down in a form which is Lorentz invariant. That is a geometrical form. It's mathematically quite exciting, but you can do it. So there is a geometrical statement of Maxwell's equations. It essentially says that the direction of the electric field vector is frame invariant. So to answer the first question first, I'll say, so the equivalence principle is telling us that the Maxwell's equations that work for our normal experience, our not living under neutron star experience, those Maxwell's equations will still work in general relativity. They'll still work in a very highly gravitating environment without change. There won't be a change that appears because you're in a curved space-time. So if you had a radio receiver, any radio receiver, either a gramophone or else the GPS receiver on your phone, if you took that close to a neutron star and were in orbit around a neutron star, would it still work? Who would say it would still work? Who would say it wouldn't still work? Have a chat about that. okay, having thought about that, let's ask the question again. So you have a radio receiver and some radio to pick up, for example, but you're in orbit around, say, a neutron star, so some highly curved space-time. Would the radio receiver still work? Who would say it would? Who would say it wouldn't? Okay. Well, it would, because of the equivalence principle. Because the equivalence principle say that even though you are in this very exotic circumstance, you're in orbit around a neutron star, you're possibly falling into a black hole. We'll come to those later. You're perhaps going to be squished into nothingness because the black hole is a very exotic situation. In your local frame, you're in free fall. So Maxwell's equations, so anything that works in special relativity in any free-falling frame still works. So you probably wouldn't be able to pick up anything because the radio waves that were broadcast from well outside would be highly blue-shifted by the time you pick them up as you're falling into the black hole. But this thing would still work because Maxwell's equations would be unchanged. And that is extraordinary. That's why that version of the equivalence principle is extraordinary, because it's telling us that we already know how physics works, even in those really exotic circumstances around a bit of space-time at the very edge of the universe. And that it gives us a big jump into how we understand what we see in those very exotic circumstances. So that's why the equivalence principle, that version of it, is such a big deal. It says we already know a large chunk of how things work near gravity. And there's a slightly longer version of that in the slides. By the way, talking about slides, it reminds me that the I don't think those are in the lecture notes folder, but by popular request, I have taken the scribbles from previous lectures and scanned them, and they're in the lecture notes folder. I'm not sure how useful they are. They weren't intended to be useful, but they're there. And I realise I haven't put the notes for Chapter 9 up in the lecture notes folder. I will put it later on today. I wanted to have a wee check over them to see if there weren't bits missing before doing so. So one of the things that we touched on last time is that we realised that because of the equivalence principle, we can say space-time tells matter how to move. We can add the extra bit of physics that just as when we are standing still in an inertial frame, we are moving through space-time in a very particular direction. We are moving along the t-axis, we move along a geodesic. That's the natural motion in that inertial frame. But that's that geodesic that we trace out, which is very easy to trace out because we're just standing here where our geodesic is pointing straight along the time axis. If we turn that into a different set of coordinates, then we are it's a long way of saying it's easy to see what our geodesic is through a space-time. It's just pointing along our time axis. In a curved space-time, Just as we saw for an individual moving across the surface of the Earth, a geodesic is a geometrical thing. It's a geometrical quantity. It's a frame-independent quantity. And so if it is, and it is still true, that our motion through space-time is what happens when we go along a geodesic in that space-time, the, quote, straight line in that space-time, then we understand how to move through a curved space-time. Because the curvature of the space-time, the shape of the space-time, tells us what effect where that geodesic, what point that geodesic actually goes through. I'm making this sound very complicated. This is very clear in my head. It's basically a long version of space-time tells matter how to move. The shape of the space-time. This is the what's being mentioned in those endless videos of people putting weights on rubber sheets and seeing the rubber sheet turn into a curved sheet and then a marble roll around in a curved path on that. The marble is discovering the geodesic in that curved space-time, and that's the point. I don't want to bang on about that. Now, what we've been talking about is in all of this is free fall under gravity. So we are talking about either jumping up and down or falling into a black hole or falling in a lift shaft, all these things. We're talking about free fall. But how does this relate to us standing on the ground or on the floor or whatever and feeling the gravitational force? Because we, you know, there's a force we can feel on the soles of our shoes. And that's where the link back to acceleration comes in. Because if the floor wasn't there, then we would move under gravity. You can imagine, if the floor suddenly disappeared, you can imagine a sort of shadow version of yourself falling falling down, and you're looking at it and getting moving faster and faster, away from you, faster and faster, accelerating away from you. Except, be careful, it's not the one that's accelerating. Remember I said that acceleration is what you feel when you're pushed. It's what you feel when the train accelerates. Whereas when you are in a local inertial frame, you are not accelerating in that sense. So that sort of ghost version of you that's falling away with the separation between you and it is increasing with a non-zero second derivative. It's not that ghost version that's accelerating, it's you that's accelerating. You are the one that's accelerating away from what you might think of as the natural motion under gravity. And so the pressure you feel on your feet is what's accelerating you. So this ghost version of you is falling, is free falling under gravity, following its sort of natural motion, strictly in scare quotes. But you, the floor is accelerating away from that ghost version. And that's the link between acceleration and gravity. So the force of gravity that we feel on the soles of our feet is the force of acceleration. And that links right back to the very beginning of chapter 8, where I talked about these objects in the box and the rocket accelerating the box and people and the objects being pushed to the floor and being accelerated by it. So that is actually a key notion, although it seems like just a simple thought experiment. And that's a profound point. And which is worth thinking about as you walk home. A final point there is that there are, if you go to the library and look at general relativity textbooks, so the body gets mathematically complicated quite quickly, but the introductory chapters of these textbooks are often very good about putting these ideas I've talked about here into different and possibly more illuminating sequences. So look, and Rindler, which I think I've mentioned a couple of times as a more advanced general relativity textbook, is good about the fundamental ideas and the sequence of ideas. So if you're puzzling into that and you want to be prompted to think more about it, then the introductory chapters of advanced books are accessible. So that was a quick recap. What I got at the very, are there any questions about that about that sort of stuff before we move on to the final section of this chapter? Okay. What I was talking about at the very end last time was Poisson's equation and the analogy between that and the equation we're going to go on to. There I said that this was the phi there was the gravitational potential, and that's just the thing that you're familiar with from your knowledge of Newtonian gravity. It's how much gravitational potential is there at this height, at this height, at this height, at this height, and so on. And the second derivative of that is constrained by the amount of mass at a point r. So in the typical thing that we're interested in, there's a lump of mass at the centre, the sun, see, and the gravitational potential that results from that is a solution of Poisson's equation. It is such that the second derivative of it is zero everywhere except at the centre. Okay, and a solution of Poisson's equation consists of identifying what rho is, okay, a dot at the centre, and then mathematically solving that equation to find what phi is. And you get a 1 over r potential, from which you get an inverse square force, for which you get Newton's gravity. Okay? So that is where Newton's gravity comes from, if you like. And I mentioned that going to Einstein's version of gravity, we end up with a version of that. We can't talk about mass in quite the same way because, as we know from chapter 7, the dynamics chapter, mass is just the sort of the time component of an angular momentum vector. So what we have to consider instead is a slightly more general object. I talked of an energy momentum tensor and talked about a tensor being the same as the stress strain tensor, which allows you to say things like what's the component of force in the x direction across a plane through this solid object, and so on. The energy momentum tensor talks about the flow of, or the momentum flux across a surface. It talks about the energy flux across the surface into the future. So it talks about the energy and momentum, or the energy and momentum inside a box, if you like, inside an object. I'm waving my hands here quite literally, because I don't want to get into the details of what that is, but the point is, it is the relativistic analogue of that mass term. So the right-hand side of the equation we're going to quote, is a mass-related thing in the same way. So what's the left-hand side? If you, I have repeatedly quoted things like the dx squared equals dx squared plus dy squared as the differential version of Pythagoras' theorem. I have talked about the d squared minus dx squared as a sort of differential version of of the interval, and has said that both of these are metrics, in the sense that they are the things that define distance in the respective spaces. Let me go with this. Now the thing that's called the metric. For example, also in spherical polars, that would be dr squared plus r d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. I'm just going to quote that just to say that's still the metric of flat 3D space, but it looks a bit more complicated because we're doing it in spherical polars. But the point is, you can see there are coefficients multiplying the various, you know, 1 r squared sine squared, multiplying the various differential elements there. And those are simple versions of a matrix, essentially. Another tensor type object, which is called the metric. Again, eliding some details, the point is that the metric, this definition of distance, ds squared, is the thing that corresponds to the potential in Poisson's equation. Because the metric is the thing that defines the shape of the curved surface. Remember, it was because we had a metric like that on the surface of the sphere that we end up discovering spherical trigonometry with its different rules about internal angles or triangles. So jumping at, so this is all saying that in order to make plausible the observation that the thing that ends up being Einstein's equation is an energy momentum tensor, which is a way of encapsulating the amount of energy momentum in a box, if you like, at a place, and another tensor G, big G, which involves the second derivatives of the of the coefficients of the metric. I am missing a lot out there. But the key thing is this, in a way, looks like Poisson's equation. In both cases, you have a thing on the left, on the right, sorry, which is related to the mass, and a thing on the left, which is related to a second derivative of the shape, if you like. In that case, the shape is just a potential. In the case of Einstein's equation, the shape is second derivatives of the metric, of the coefficients of the metric. There's not much I can say about that before, without going into way too much mathematical detail that would occupy us for another few months. But the key thing is that analogy is real. It is a valid analogy. And to point out that this equation, this is what Einstein published in 1915, plus definitions of what G is. So that expands to a big set of equations. But it's basically a simple idea. And that is another of these physical statements. You can imagine that being otherwise. It is mathematically reasonable for that to be otherwise. And there were some other alternatives that Einstein tried first, to think, it's bound to be this. This is bound to be the physical law that's going to explain everything. And they didn't work out. So over the course of some years and months leading up to the end of 1915, he eventually discovered that there was a way of putting things together that identified a quantity of G and a quantity of T, for which this equation, this equality, explained everything. And we're going to discover how it explains things in a moment. So there's not much you can do with that. In fact, there's basically nothing you can do with that because maths. But the reason I'm showing it to you is simply to show that in a sense it's quite simple. But in a sense it's also very hard, because these are equations linking multiple components of these matrices. So those are both. So that equation there represents 10 simultaneous second order differential equations. And that's not easy to solve. And they have not been solved in general. What has happened is people have solved them in particular cases, particular special cases, particular simple cases, and we'll discover those. So no general solution of that exists, only analytic solutions of special cases, which we're going to learn about. But the point here, then, is this allows us to complete the other half of the famous slogan. Space-time tells matter how to curve. The curvature of the space-time governs the geodesics in the space-time, and the geodesics are how we move through things. And matter tells space-time how to curve. The distribution of energy and momentum in a space governs, that is what governs the shape of that space-time. So the two things link together. And that is the key insight of general relativity, if you like. Math fills in the details, but that is the key insight, and it links very smoothly to special relativity. So one of the questions that came up, I think on the Padlet was, why are we studying special relativity again? I'm not sure if that was how it was explained, but is the application of special relativity, and there are applications of special relativity within particle physics. You can't design CERN without knowing a lot about special relativity. But the other big thing, the very important thing, and the thing that's very important for you as astronomers, is that I want you to have a very clear picture in your head of how smoothly special relativity turns into general relativity. Special relativity is the key link that goes from the physics that we understand to the physics that we don't yet. We'll come back to that sort of picture later. Okay, on to chapter 9. And breathe. Are there any questions about that suddenly occur to anybody? I mean, there will be plenty of questions as you mull this over in your heads, and so do ask those. But these are some of the most exciting ideas in physics of the 20th century, and the thing that's more exciting than these is in the 21st century things like string theory and quantum gravity and stuff. But this links directly to that. So this is all a classical theory. Okay, moving on. So in this chapter, this is the final chapter, and we'll have a lecture and a half to get through it. I'm going to just talk about solutions to Einstein's equation. So I quoted Einstein's equation there and said, details complicated. But a solution to Einstein's equation is when you take a configuration of matter and energy, whatever, on the right hand, you can write down fairly easily what the right hand side of that equation is, what the energy momentum tensor is. And it's then a case of finding what is the metric, what are the coefficients of the all these coefficients of the metric, such as the what's the factors in front of dr, d theta, and d phi? What are those coefficients in front of that, which satisfy Einstein's equations? And when you've got that, that's a solution to Einstein's equation. It gives you a space-time which is curved in the right way. Okay. So the objectives here are rather hand-waving ones. You know, give a qualitative account and so on. What we're going to cover is the weak field solution. And the weak field solution is the case of the extreme case where the energy momentum tensor on the right-hand side is small. And as you will be familiar from other bits of education, extreme cases such as small mass are solvable in a way that the more general things aren't. We'll discover the Schwarzschild spacetime, which is extreme in the case that there is only one mass in the universe. That's another extreme case which happens to be solvable. We'll briefly touch on gravitational waves, which are interesting because they're a source-less solution, in the sense that gravitational waves don't depend on any masses being there to propagate. They're all about gravitational waves propagating through an otherwise empty space-time. And we'll briefly touch on, if we have time, on the solution of the of Einstein's equations, which refers to the entire universe, which is another extreme case. So we can say a little bit about all of these things. Now, here's another metric. And this is actually similar to what we've seen before, because if you ignore that bit, which I'll come to in a moment, that metric there is just dt squared minus dx squared. But when I haven't written dx squared, I've written d sigma squared, and d sigma squared is, I will occasionally refer to it as is dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared. So it's just the distance element of Euclidean spacetime. So that's flat space. That's what d sigma is. So without that there, that's just the metric of special relativity spacetime. It's dt squared minus dx squared, basically. But if you think back to the beginning of chapter 8, one of the thought experiments I talked about was this idea of a mass falling, being turned into a photon, and rising again, and we were able to deduce that there was a redshift which happened to the photon at that point. And I showed you, I showed you, that you could characterize that redshift by the gravitational potential, and Newton's gravitational potential. How high above the mass are you? And detail. You can I'm trying to use the phrase "it can be shown that" as little as possible, but I'm not going to succeed very much in this final section. So I think that I haven't expanded that in the notes, and I've just said it can be shown that the way that observation of a redshift coming through a gravitational field can be held together is if the distance between. That's it. You remember the Shields photon thing that I very briefly mentioned, where you had two, a Minkowski diagram with two photons going vertically upwards after a delay, and we discovered, and I very quickly mentioned that you could see, because of the redshift of the photon climbing through the field, that the lengths between the times between the endpoints of those arriving photons were and the departing photons were different. Blah blah blah. Doesn't matter. The point is, you can justify this as a metric for the space-time, where this function phi, this coefficient in front of the dt squared component, is this recognizable expression here, gm over r. And this is in natural units, so this ends up being a very small number in these units. So this is 1 plus a small number. In other words, this metric is very nearly the Minkowski metric, but with an extra term here, an extra small term here, which allows you to, which slightly deviates from that. There's more one can say about that, but I'm going to move on to the reason I mentioned that is because you can go from note that you can go from essentially the arguments in the beginning of chapter 8 about the redshift arguments and the Schultz photons arguments to that metric fairly directly. You don't have to use any general relativity. I'm not going to say any more about that. What I am going to say instead is that, but the point of that is that you don't use Einstein's equation in that. You can, in a slightly clever way, tiptoe in to talking about curved space times without actually using Einstein's equation. If, however, you start with Einstein's equation, the G equals kappa T, and look at it in the extreme case of a very small mass. And a small mass here is something less dense than a neutron star. So a star or a galaxy or something like that. So it's a small mass. And if in that case a galaxy probably wouldn't have a star, whatever, something anonymously small, then you can do a lot of the mathematical complication at that point falls away, and you end up with a low mass version of Einstein's equation, which is solvable. And it's solvable in the sense that you can find a metric which satisfies that equation, and that solution is this one. It's called the weak field solution. And again, you can see that if I ignore bits of it, that's still dt squared minus dx squared. So that's still vague. That's still close to being the Minkowski metric. So the space-time in around a small mass object is still, this is saying, basically that of special relativity. But with some perturbations from it, which and this pops out from Einstein's equation, which have this form, this gm over r, which is the potential that you find in Newton's gravity. And this, if you like, is the first test of general relativity. And so I think Einstein had a happy day when he worked this out. That if you go from Einstein's equations, take the low mass limit of them, then what you get is an expression which involves something which is very clearly identifiable as the Turing potential. And if you then turn a different handle and ask, okay, what are the geodesics in this space-time? Do I have a picture of those? Yeah. You discover, those are the equations of motion for the geodesics. Okay, does that help us? It does help us. Because though that P there is the energy momentum vector. If you remember, that's the thing with E in the time component and the spatial momentum in the spatial components. And what that first equation is saying is that the rate of change of the zero component of the energy momentum of a test particle is proportional to the rate of change of phi with time. And so if the star we're talking about isn't changing mass, which it won't be, the right-hand side will be zero. So the zero component of the energy momentum of our test particle will be constant. In other words, energy is conserved as things move around in this space-time. And this second equation, which is I in the spatial sector, is a way of writing F equals minus M del phi, which is Newton's law of universal gravitation. In other words, the low mass limit of Einstein's equations is solvable to give a metric, to give a space-time which is curved, slightly curved, because again, phi is much smaller than one, is slightly curved in a particular way. And when we ask what are the geodesics in that space-time, how do particles move in that space-time, we discover they move in the same way, that Newton says they move. So we have invented Newton's law of universal gravitation. So Newton's law of universal gravitation is a pretty direct consequence of one of the simplification number one of Einstein's equations. That is a solution of Einstein's equations. And that is pretty mind-blowing, I think. And that is one of the first tests of general relativity. That's one of the first reassurances that you're onto something with that Einstein's guess of G equals kappa T, that was right as a physical statement. We should just meditate on that just for 10 seconds and think how wonderful that is. Good stuff. Key points. So that was we've looked at two simplifications there. We looked at the very first thing I mentioned, which was I'll miss that out next time. A version of a way of getting a curved space-time which doesn't use Einstein's equation, but is fairly directly follows from the thought experiments we had at the beginning of chapter 8, is one thing. The simple case of very low mass and non-relativistic motion, I should also mention, gives us an Einstein equation which is solvable fairly straightforwardly to give Newton's laws. But the other simplification that we can make to a scenario is not that different from that weak field solution. It's to say, what happens if we have only a single mass in the universe, only a single massive object in the universe, an empty universe with single mass in it. What is the shape of the space-time around that? And we're going to not talk about things moving at non-relativistic speeds. We'll talk about things moving as fast as we want, so we won't have that restriction. That restriction is implicit in the previous weak field version. And Einstein's equations Einstein published those Einstein's equations in 1915. And in 1916, so only a year later, Karl Schwarzschild found a solution to that other simple case, where there's only a single mass in the universe. And this is all the more impressive because Schwarzschild was an officer in the army and was in the middle of the First World War. So there were literally shells going overhead when he was trying to work this out. There's a variety of ways of distracting yourself, but solving Einstein's equations is one of the more stylish ones, I think. Anyway, Schwarzschild discovered that this was a solution to Einstein's equations in that special case of a single mass. And this also, if you were to take R to be zero, you see this also is dt squared minus dr squared minus r squared d omega squared. D omega squared there is this d theta squared plus sine squared d phi squared. That's the area element on the surface of a sphere. Is all the omega is there. So you can see that if r is zero, that also reduces to Minkowski, the Minkowski metric. So that also is compatible with special relativity. You can also see that in the spatial sector, that's the dr and d phi and d omega. So that's on the surface of the sphere. That's the radial component. That they are no longer flat. So this is spatially curved as well as curved in space time. And other things that follow, that are worth pointing out there are. That this, I have, for some reason I haven't written it up. This big R there is a parameter which has the same which has the same dimensions as a radius. So the radial scale here is governed by this parameter, big R, and that. That R is called the Schwarzschild radius. What is that parameter R? Well, in physical units, it's 2gm over c squared. So again, there's something reminiscent of Newton's gravity in there. And that radius there is the radius on which this Schwarzschild solution deviates from a flat. That characterizes the length scale on which the Schwarzschild solution deviates from flat space. What number does that produce? If you put in the numbers there for that g, by the way, is not confusingly Einstein's tensor, but Newton's constant, Newton's constant gravity of gravitation. If you put the numbers in there with, for example, the mass of the Sun, then the Schwarzschild radius of the Sun is 1.5 kilometers. So if the mass of the Sun were compressed into something smaller than 1.5 kilometers, yes, it would be a black hole. And that's where we're about to come to. But that radius, R, would be 1.5 kilometers. And whenever R was bigger, was much bigger, the ratio between that Schwarzschild radius R and the radial parameter little r is how much this deviates from being just flat space-time, flat Minkowski space-time. So out here, when we are 500 light seconds from the Sun, that R here is much bigger than the 1.5 kilometers. So out here, space-time isn't curved at all, really. Basically not curved at all. It is, but it's very, very small. It's small by a factor of 1.5 kilometers over 500 light seconds. It means not very much. And the, I can't remember offhand what the Schwarzschild radius of the Earth is. You can work out your own Schwarzschild radius if you wanted to. And I'll also mention, just in the last few minutes, that those are some ways of writing down the some sample version, so that the GM is that the gravitational constant times the mass of the Sun is that, or 1.5 kilometers in natural units, and that number at the top there, 1.327 at 10 to the 20, actually has a lot more decimal places to it, because it can be measured quite very precisely, because you can make very precise measurements of things like artificial satellites in orbit around the Sun and measure that very carefully. So you can characterize that's called the gravitational parameter of the Sun. And this is, I'm not talking about GR here, but just that parameter. You can characterize that very, very precisely, which I think to sort of like 8 significant figures, or 7 or 8 significant figures. But then, to work out what the mass of the Sun is, what you do is you take that gravitational parameter, GM, and you divide by G. How do you get G? You make experiments on Earth with things like torsion balances and so on. But those figures for big G, the gravitational constant, you know, it's a hard measurement to do. So you only know those to perhaps three significant figures. So you're dividing this quite accurate number by a number which is not only three significant figures. So you get the mass of the Sun in kilograms to only three significant figures. So we know the spatial radius of the Sun, GM, to about eight significant figures. But we know the mass of the Sun in kilograms. So that's the mass of the Sun in meters, is what we know. But to convert that to the mass of the Sun in kilograms, we have to divide by a number we don't know very well. So we know the radius of the Sun, the mass of the Sun in meters, better than we know the radius of the Sun. We know the mass of the Sun in meters better than we know the mass of the Sun in kilograms. And that's a striking thing, I think. And that's the gravitational radius of the Earth there. Before I go, I think next time, that's a good place to stop, and next time we'll pick things up and you'll talk actually about black holes in somewhat complicated.